Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Matthew McGill for the PG&E trade creditors. PG&E is a solvent debtor that designated its general unsecured creditors as unimpaired under Section 1124.1 of the Code. PG&E's plan, therefore, had to, quote, leave unaltered all of our legal, equitable, and contractual rights. As the Third Circuit explained in PPI Enterprises, quote, the failure to pay post-petition interest does not leave unaltered the contractual or legal rights of the claim, end quote. Yet PG&E's plan here cut creditors' post-petition interest by nearly 75% to send a windfall of hundreds of millions of dollars to an entirely solvent debtor.
So can you help me with this Section 502B, which apparently provides that claims are frozen at the time of the petition, and so by law the unimpaired creditors don't have a claim for post-petition interest. What do we do with the statutory requirement there?
Your Honor, I think we start with the text of the code. And what the text of 502b2 prohibits is including in the amount of an allowed claim post-petition interest or unmatured interest in the statutory text.
Right.
You cannot include post-petition interest in the amount of the allowed claim. But for 300 years, it has been permissible to pay post-petition interest on an allowed claim. You can see that in the text of the code itself in section 726A5.
But those are always for a different, they're not for the unimpaired creditors. So therefore other sorts of like 726A is for creditors in liquidation and 1129A7 is for impaired creditors. Right. So the thing that concerns me is we have 502B pretty clear saying that, and we've interpreted that as saying that claims for post-petition interest on unsecured claims are prohibited. And then we have the Supreme Court's decision in Law v. Siegel saying that the bankruptcy court can't exercise its equitable authority in contradiction to the statutes and the code. So how do we avoid that? There's really nothing in the code about solvent debtors. The cases are primarily before Law v. Siegel. So help me understand how we could do the, find that the solvent debtor exception supersedes 502B.
Our argument is not the solvent debtor supersedes 502B2. It is, our argument is that the, that 502B2 does not prohibit payment of interest on an allowed claim at the conclusion of the bankruptcy. I think that the Supreme Court's decision in American Iron explains the rationale for the distinction that I'm drawing here. In American Iron, what the Supreme Court explained is that if we included post-petition interest in the amount of the allowed claim, that would advantage creditors who had higher rates of interest at the expense of creditors who had lower rates of interest. But once you're talking about a solvent debtor that has amounts, has assets sufficient to pay post-petition interest, it has always been true for 300 years that the code and before it, the Bankruptcy Act, permits the payment of post-petition interest on the allowed claim. And that was, you know, I can cite to you the cases of Consolidated, the Supreme Court's decision in Consolidated Rock, the First Circuit's decision in Debenture Holders, the Sixth Circuit's decision in Dow Corning.
Were those on 502B? I mean, the thing that concerns me a bit is that when Congress wanted to provide post-petition interest of varying sorts, is specifically provided for that in the code, which raises the inference that it didn't intend to do that for unimpaired creditors in a Chapter 11 case.
I think, Your Honor, that the Butner and Raleigh and Travelers counsel the opposite inference, that in the absence of a code provision that clearly changes or abrogates state law rights, we apply the state law rights. The claim here is the right to payment as defined by non-bankruptcy law. I would look to this court's decision in In Re Fitness Holdings for that proposition. And so because 502b2 does not prohibit payment of interest on the allowed claim, that therefore we have a situation where if there are assets sufficient for it, if a claim is to be unimpaired, as PG&E did here of its own free will, then post-petition interest should be paid. The real anomaly here is that we as unimpaired creditors are worse off than if we had been designated as impaired creditors. If we had been designated as impaired creditors, we could have invoked the fair and equitable test of 1129B. We could have voted on the plan. We would have voted to reject it.
Did you qualify as unimpaired creditors? I thought you didn't qualify as unimpaired. As impaired. I thought you didn't. You were unimpaired because you're getting the full amount of your claim as of the time of the petition. So you wouldn't qualify as impaired.
Your Honor, that is our at the core of our dispute is that we were improperly designated as unimpaired. They did that to deprive us of a vote, so we could not litigate the fairness and equitableness of the plan.
In addition to stripping you of the vote, they strip the unimpaired creditors of the right to negotiate in any way with the bankrupt estate, correct?
I think that's right, Your Honor. But the key point here is that if we had been permitted a vote, we could have litigated.
Why were you impaired? Maybe I missed that. Why were you impaired?
We were impaired for the same reason the creditors in New Valley were impaired in the view of Congress, because the solvent debtor did not pay us the post-petition interest that we were due.
Okay, so you're saying two things at the same time. One, you're saying the post-petition interest is just something extra that you get. It's not controlled by 502B. And now you're saying, oh, but we were impaired because we didn't get that post-petition interest. So I'm confused now. Which is it? Was that part of your claim or not part of your claim? Because if it's not part of your claim, you weren't impaired.
Your Honor, our claim is defined by is our right to payment under non-bankruptcy law. That includes interest until the date of payment.
But that's not what the bankruptcy code says, right? It says it 502B says it's frozen at the time of the petition.
That 502B2 does indeed define what is allowed as part of the allowed claim. Correct. But that does not, if that were true, Your Honor, then no one could ever be paid any post-petition interest, right? Because it would not be part of the, there could be no post-petition interest paid on allowed claims.
I mean, the code provides for it. Do you want to save the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. We'll hear from the other side.
I'm just going to switch my seating area. Since we have a podium, I might as well use it. Okay, good afternoon, Your Honors. Theodore Tsekarides on behalf of PG&E. Your Honors, the issue on this appeal is straightforward and one that this court addressed and resolved in Cartolucci almost 20 years ago.
So, counsel, there's sort of an oddity here in that I think most of the questions that Judge Ikuda was asking, she could be asking to your side too, right? Because you don't disagree that post-petition interest needs to be paid here, and the bankruptcy judge didn't disagree. So you agree it should be paid. The whole issue in this case is just what rate, right?
Exactly right.
So why should, maybe try to convince Judge Acuda why post-petition interest should be paid?
Well, I think there are, so I think Cartolucci really is worth a read.
Well, Cartolucci is for a different section. It's a section which provides, is interpreting a section that provides for post-petition interest. So there you can say, well, the reasoning in Cartolucci is it's at the federal rate. I understand that. I don't understand, since there's no basis for post-petition interest for unimpaired creditors in this sort of case, I don't see how there's any basis for picking one rate over the other. Cartolucci is not on point.
Respectfully, Judge Akito, it is on point. Let me tell you why. So first of all, there's nothing in Cartolucci that limits it to impaired claims. It did analyze a section you're talking about.
It was a statutory interpretation.
Right. It's section 726, but it did more, Your Honor. It did more. It did two other things. It talked about the federal judgment rate being applicable to general unsecured claims, which these unimpaired claimants are. They're not reinstated claims. They're not cure claims. They're not admin claims. They're general unsecured claims. And so that 726A5 section that you're referring to, that talks about post-petition interest rate. But Cartolucci did more. It also said because of promoting uniformity within federal law and the fact, and I think this is important, and the fact that an allowed claim in bankruptcy is akin to a judgment. And Cartolucci said this, and so did the cases that the other side relies on.
So even I saw the parts in Cartolucci where they were talking about their rejecting appellant substantive due process claim, which is where I think you bring out your uniformity argument. Of course, substantive due process isn't really an issue here, right?
Well, it's not, but that's not where Cartolucci talked about uniformity. It talked about it earlier on in the decision when it was, again, equating post-petition interest to post-judgment interest in federal court. And I think this actually could solve the problem that apparently we're discussing here. If you follow through, 502A and B of the code together tell us that if a claimant files a proof of claim, it's deemed allowed. And it's deemed allowed as of the petition date. And Cartolucci and other courts have said that's akin to a judgment, including the solvent debtor cases that were referred to by the appellants. So in the solvent debtor analysis, all they said was, if the debtor is solvent, you have to pay them some post-petition interest. None of those cases from 1910, 1914, 1911 said what rate. But
so counsel, can I ask you about that? Because sure. They didn't say a rate, but was there a bank? What is this rate called again? I always forget the exact name, but the
Judgment rate?
The federal judgment rate, yeah. Was there a federal judgment rate back then?
No, and that's a great point, Judge Van Dyke, and let me take you through why that confirms that we're right. There was no federal judgment rate, but they said equate it to a judgment. The federal judgment rate standard, post-judgment interest, didn't come into effect until 1948. But in 1948, that rate was whatever the state said in their particular form. So if you were in federal court in Ohio, it might be different than if you're in federal court.
We don't have to speculate in this case about what the rate may have been. There was a contractual interest rate designated under your agreements with these claimants, wasn't there?
There was. For some, others don't have contracts.
But what you're asking us to do is to take your position vis-a-vis a contractual obligation that you had, and to have us declare that all of a sudden that contract is rewritten by the federal courts by designating the rate at some rate other than what you agreed to pay.
I'm not doing that at all.
Oh, that is precisely what you're doing. By designating these claimants as unimpaired, you essentially strip them of the right to vote on your plan. You strip them of the right to negotiate. You put them in a worse position than if they had been impaired. And you're asking us to vindicate this position by interpreting the statute in a way totally inconsistent with the way it was historically interpreted, and more importantly, inconsistent with your very own contractual obligations. Now, persuade me that I'm wrong.
I will. I will try anyway. The historical cases that you refer to, the solvent debtor cases, those are the historical cases. None of them said they get their contract rates. They equate them to a judgment. In federal court right now, if a plaintiff brought an action in state court and I removed it to federal court, it doesn't matter that they had a contract rate. If we're in federal court, post-judgment interest, notwithstanding any contract, notwithstanding any state law statute, is the federal judgment rate under 28 U.S. Code 1961. We didn't change a thing. We gave them exactly what they were entitled to. What their claim was, we paid them in full. Their underlying claim, there was nothing to negotiate. Whatever they asked for, they got. That was their claim. And their claim is fixed as of the petition date. And if you equate that to a judgment, which all the cases do, then it's just like paying post-judgment interest in federal court. And that's at the federal judgment rate. Notwithstanding a contract, nobody says that's unfair. Notwithstanding a contract in federal court.
Well, counsel, I'm following you, and we don't have a lot of time in this case, so I want to pinpoint something.
Sure.
I think if I understand your argument correctly, that you're saying, yes, I agree that back in the old days, 100 years ago, they would have gotten whatever the state rate, default rate was, or whatever their contractual rate was. But now they would get the federal judgment rate. What changed that? What precisely changed that? And what in the, you know, what in the code, and when did that change?
So what changed that? So again, and I invite the court to go back and read those cases.
Is it 726? Are you saying 726 changed that?
I'm saying two things, Your Honor. Okay. 726 is the codification, in our view, of the solvent debtor exception. 726 has a waterfall of payments. The last one, 726A6.
But you got a problem with that argument. You got a problem with that argument that it only applies to impaired debtors, and these are unimpaired debtors, right?
That, well, I don't know that there's a problem. 1129A7 says impaired, but if you consider the other principle in bankruptcy law that like creditors are treated the same, the unimpaired general unsecured creditor and the impaired general unsecured creditor are general unsecured.
This goes to Judge Lucero's concern, which is that you're not treating them same because you're not giving them a seat at the table. You're not giving them a seat at the table, but you're still like hitting them with this lower rate. So they don't have the ability to vote, and they also don't have the ability to come before the court and say, this is not fair and equitable. So you're not actually treating them the same.
No, but we are, Your Honor. Again, what is there to negotiate? If you say I owe you $100 and I pay you $100, there's nothing to negotiate. That's your claim. It's $100.
But what if I say you owe me $100 plus interest at 10% pursuant to your contract?
But again, if you consider that your claim is fixed as of the petition date and post-petition interest is like post-judgment interest in all of these other cases, I haven't done anything to you that you're not entitled to. The other guys who were impaired, there were some claimants who said they were owed $20 billion and we paid them $11 billion. Those guys were impaired. Those guys we had to negotiate with. But somebody, if we owed them $100 and we paid them $100 and then gave them interest at the federal judgment rate because it's akin to post-judgment
counsel,
interest.
Counsel, if you're correct, I mean, I hear your example. The problem is that basically there's no getting around the fact that clients like yours are able to manipulate, solvent clients are able to manipulate the judgment, the bankruptcy laws in order to give a haircut to all of these people that otherwise would be getting paid contractual or default rates that are well above 2.whatever%. And your only response, as best I can tell from the briefing, is, yeah, but that's what the law requires. But that's a little bit circular, right? You're saying that's what the law requires. Why would anybody have made a rule like that when the background rule is this equitable rule that when you have a solvent debtor, you pay the creditors first and only the debtor last?
Again, Your Honor, respectfully, the solvent debtor exception does not say just pay them the contract rates.
You keep saying that, but 100 years ago, I think you've acknowledged 100 years ago they would have gotten either the contract or the default rates.
Well, that's
all these cases you're saying that don't stand for that, there was no other rate to pay them. Like, and there are cases that say, if I remember right, that they need to be made whole. Isn't that what the Supreme Court case that starts with a C says? Don't they, right?
Well, so respectfully, we submit we did make them whole because if you equate it to a judgment, there is a statute. We can't ignore the fact that 28 U.S. Code 1961 exists. And if the court said this is just like a federal judgment, That's what the cases say. I'm not making it up. It says it's just like a federal judgment.
The courts say that. The court that you're saying Carlucci says that, right?
Yeah. Vanston says it as well. There are other courts. The Bencher says that as well, too. There are other courts that say, and in fact, Johnson v. Norris, the case from back in 1911 that they say is the predicate for the solvent debtor exception, and John Osborne's, which it cites to, those cases specifically say this is just like a judgment in federal court. So if it's like a judgment in federal court, we treated it exactly the same. And again, we didn't take anything away from them. They had a claim. We paid the claim in full, unlike some others who got less. That's what made other people impaired and not them.
I'm over my time, Your Honors. I'm taking the presiding judge privilege to ask one more question. What is the statutory link that would say that 1129A17 for impaired class gets the same treatment as the unimpaired class here in Chapter 11? Is there a statute or a statutory pathway?
If I heard the question correctly, 1129A7, what's the pathway using that to unimpaired claims? Is that the question, Your Honor?
Right. That says, A17 says that impaired class gets the same sort of post-petition interest as for Chapter 7. And you said, and the unimpaired should be treated exactly the same way. And so I wanted to know if there was a statute that said that.
There's no specific statute that I'm aware of that says that, Your Honor, but as we've argued in the briefs, because they're both general unsecured creditors, and equating it to the federal judgment rate, which again, I do invite the court to go back and look at those cases, Johnson v. Norris and John Osborne's. But thank you very much if there are no further questions.
All right, there's some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just make a few quick points. First,
so counsel, can I get you to focus on counsel? Can I get you to focus on specifically the issue of assuming that you have the right, as the solvent debtor exception still exists, focus on why it should be the contract or the default rate as opposed to, like, what is it that should it be that, especially like historically, why it should be that instead of being the federal judgment rate?
Because that is because a solvent debtor should pay its debts. And that is the money, that is what we are entitled to in non-bankruptcy law. The cases that specify contractual rates, Consolidated Rock, debentures from the First Circuit, debenture holders from the First Circuit, Dow Corning from the Sixth Circuit, the recent bankruptcy court decisions in Ultra and Mullins.
I think your opposing counsel would say, well, but the modern cases have said that it's similar to, including, I guess, our Carlucci case, have said that it's similar to other civil actions where you get paid the federal judgment. Why do those not apply?
Well, because I think for two reasons, Your Honor. First, you start with the Butner principle that says our claim is defined and our rights under our claim are defined by state law. And federal law curtails them only to the extent it explicitly curtails them. The federal judgment statute does not apply, judgment rate statute does not, by its plain text, even remotely suggest application to bankruptcy court cases. It talks about the marshal levying for execution. We can't do that with an allowed claim. An allowed claim is not actually like a judgment. This is an effort by a solvent debtor to analogize to a federal judgment in an effort to try to make an inapplicable statute apply to limit our state law rates. That is contrary to Butner, Raleigh, and Travelers, all Supreme Court decisions. The last point I want to make is that the real irony here is that we are worse off than if we had been declared an impaired creditor. If we had been declared impaired, we would have voted to reject the plan, we would have litigated the fair and equitable test, and we would have won because this violates the absolute priority rule. And under the Supreme Court's decision in Norwest Bank Worthington, that makes the plan unconfirmable. We would have won under Consolidated Rock, under In Re Debenture Holders, and others.
Can you wrap up, please? You're way well over time.
Yes, Your Honor. I just wanted to come back to your point, Your Honor, with respect to 502b2. The best evidence that 502b2 does not preclude the payment of interest, post-petition interest on claims, is the New Valley repeal. When Congress repealed 1124(3) as part of the Bankruptcy Reform Act in 1994, it did so specifically to make sure that solvent debtors would pay post-petition interest. It was specifically to ensure that. When PG&E deprived us of a vote, it committed to leave in place all of our legal and equitable and contractual rights. That means we must be paid the interest we bargained for. It can't be that a debtor can end run the absolute priority rule by designating its creditors as unimpaired. That duplicates the result of New Valley.
I think we have your arguments. We thank both sides for your arguments in this interesting case. In the case of the Ad Hoc Committee of Holders of Trade Claims versus PG&E Corporation is submitted. We have one other case, United States of America versus Wing Wo Ma, and that's submitted on the briefs. And we are adjourned for this session. Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Stands adjourned.
Anybody in the building, but anyway.
Watch Jan, she's sneaky.
Thank you very much.